Welcome to the History of the Americans podcast, episode 149. I'm your host, Jack Henneman, and I'm recording this episode on April 22nd, 2024, in Austin, Texas. We are telling the history of the lands now encompassed by the United States from the beginning without intentional presentism. I'm going to be in downtown Houston for the afternoon and evening of Friday, May 17th, and would be delighted to meet up with listeners, whether or not long-standing and attentive, while my wife hangs out with fellow hedge shrinkers. My thought is to get together roughly 4 in the afternoon, maybe to 7, someplace that serves good beer, Central Houston. If you think you would show up, send me a note at thehistoryoftheamericans@gmail.com. Through the contact page for the website, or by direct message on Twitter. And if we get some reasonable critical mass, my over-under is probably 4 or 5, we'll find a place and set it up. The other bit of news is that I'm making a chronological timeline of essentially all the dates that I mention in the podcast, with links back to the relevant episodes. It's a work in progress. Now roughly through the Coronado and Soto Entradas in the 1540s. And you can find it by clicking on the timeline link at the top of the homepage of the website, thehistoryoftheamericans.com. Check it out and admire my web building skills. Did it myself. In the last episode, we looked at the founding of New Haven Colony and its spinoff colonies, which took us to the early 1640s. It would behoove you to listen to that episode before this one, but if you simply must jump in here, these were the main points. 1. Theophilus Eaton and John Davenport, chums going back to their school days, desired to start their own settlement in the New World. 2. They did this at New Haven in 1638, outside of the jurisdiction of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, but within at least one old claim of the Connecticut Colony, and without any authorization from either Parliament or the Crown back in England. They tried to legitimize their colony by purchasing an Indian deed. 3. They set up a strictly religious Puritan government. Only church members could serve as officials or even vote. There were very few people who qualified as church members, and the law would be based entirely on the scriptures, even at the expense of ancient English legal traditions not mentioned in the Bible, such as trial by jury. 4. The New Haven settlers included in their ranks some very wealthy men with commercial aspirations. And finally, 5. Between 1639 and 1642, New Haven would spin off 4 new settlements, Milford, Guilford, Stamford, and Southold on Long Island. The first 2 would not subject themselves to New Haven's jurisdiction until 1643, when the United Colonies of New England were established. But Stamford and Southold joined New Haven from their beginnings. Later, New Haveners set up new towns at Branford and Greenwich. I'm not going to belabor the United Colonies, because Eric Yanis, host of the Other States of America History podcast, has recently done such a comprehensive job on them. I'll put links in the show notes on the website. For our purposes, I'll only mention a few points that are important for this episode. They are 1. The United Colonies were formed among the Puritan colonies of Massachusetts Bay, Plymouth, Connecticut Colony, and New Haven Colony in May 1643. 2. Providence Plantations, New Hampshire, and Maine settlements were turned down for admission because they were insufficiently churched up. Too many nonconformists and heretics and all of that. 3. The main purpose was mutual defense, which could include preemptive offensive war. Prospective enemies included regional tribes, the French, and the Dutch. 4. The secondary purpose was to convey to England the impression of institutional heft, and therefore legitimacy. 5. Decisions among the colonies were mostly made by supermajority. Each colony had 2 delegates for a total of 8, and decisions, including to raise troops and wage war, could be made by any 6 delegates. this would become relevant. And finally, 6. New Haven Colony had the fewest people and soldiers, and it was particularly sensitive to security concerns because of its proximity to the Mohawks and the Dutch, who claim for their territory everything between the Delaware and Connecticut rivers. That should do it for our purposes. For more details and nuance on the United Colonies, I'll leave you to the great work of the Other States of American History podcast. In this episode, we'll tackle New Haven Colony's fairly interesting commercial affairs, its limited military endeavors, and finish up with its absorption by Connecticut Colony. As last week, the main source is Edward Elias Atwater's comprehensive History of the Colony of New Haven to its absorption into Connecticut. New Haven had attracted more than its share of rich men, most of whom were merchant traders in the manner of William Pynchon up in Springfield, you know him, or William Coddington at Newport, rather than planters. With the advantage of New Haven's excellent harbor, they aimed to turn it into a major port city. Quite early, they began to trade along the coast with Boston, New Amsterdam, the English, Dutch, and Swedish settlements on the Delaware Bay, and Virginia. The New Haveners would export furs, of course, but also soon produce wheat, hardtack biscuit, beer, pork, and hides for export. In return, they would buy European manufacturers from Boston and cotton, sugar, molasses, rum, and tobacco from the West Indies and Virginia, which they would either consume themselves or trade to the Dutch or English. The New Haveners were also interested in expanding beyond the four satellite towns. Long-standing and attentive listeners remember the failed attempt to build a settlement on the Delaware Bay, failed because neither the Dutch nor the Swedes would permit it. You've heard one version. Here's how Atwater, a New Haven booster, told it, quote, "Within 3 years after the foundations of government had been laid at New Haven, there was a purchase made by some particular persons of sundry plantations in Delaware Bay, at their own charge, for the advancement of public good, as in a way of trade, so also for the settling of churches and plantations in those parts in combination with this. This attempt to establish an English settlement in Delaware Bay encountered opposition from the Dutch and from the Swedes, both of whom claimed exclusive jurisdiction in those waters, and though contending one with the other, united in resisting the English. In 1642, the governor of New Amsterdam, that would have been Willem Kieft for those of you keeping track at home, dispatched an armed force and with great hostility burned the English trading houses, violently seized and for a time detained their goods, and would not give them time to take an inventory of them. The Dutch also took the company's boat and a number of the English planters whom they kept as prisoners. The damages done to the English at Delaware were estimated at £1,000 sterling. The same year, the Swedish governor, that would have been Peter Hollander Ritter, who had succeeded Peter Minuit, seized and imprisoned George Lamberton, master of the pinnace called the Cock, and some of his seamen, on a false charge of inciting the Indians to rise against the Swedes. Back to me. Ritter couldn't actually prove the charge, so he let Lamberton go after he paid a fine for trading on the Delaware. In 1651, after the formation of the United Colonies, settlers from New Haven and Branford, yet another spin-off town, set off again for the Delaware Bay, bearing a commission to do so from Governor Eaton and a letter from the governor of Massachusetts to Peter Stuyvesant, now the governor of New Netherland. Believing themselves well within their rights, they stopped at New Amsterdam and presented their documents to Stuyvesant, who arrested them all and would not let them go until they had sworn not to go to the Delaware. There would be a third attempt by New Haveners to settle the Delaware, but it never got off the ground, about 1655. All of this flailing around came to the attention of Oliver Cromwell, now Lord Protector of the Commonwealth. He suggested, or requested, that New Haveners move to Ireland, which he had decisively conquered, or Jamaica, which he had taken from the Spanish in May 1655. It appears the idea was taken seriously, as it would have been wise to do. After considerable debate, however, in May 1656, the General Court of the colony resolved to stay in place, responding to Cromwell delicately, quote, "Though they cannot but acknowledge the great love, care, and tender respect of His Highness the Lord Protector to New England in general, and to this colony in particular, yet for diverse reasons, they cannot conclude that God calls them to a present remove." Back to me. One wonders how differently the histories of both New England and Jamaica would have unfolded if large numbers of Puritans had heeded Cromwell's request and moved to Jamaica, which had a European population of only about 2,500 at the time. This much seems certain. Those New Englanders chose wisely, because had they gone to Jamaica, they would have died in droves, just as happened to the English who moved there from the mother country over the next century. New Haven was, however, dependent on visiting English ships for trade beyond the coast of North America. This was, of course, annoying to men like George Lamberton and Theophilus Eaton, who wanted their own transatlantic capability. To that end, a company was formed with, it should be said, an awesome name, the Ship Fellowship. The Ship Fellowship commissioned the construction, perhaps in Rhode Island, of a substantial merchant ship capable of sailing the high seas, and it was ready to launch from New Haven in January 1646, destination England. She was loaded with exports, including wheat, furs, and probably commodities purchased from Barbadian merchants, and more than 70 passengers from New Haven who had reason to go back. Her master was George Lamberton, he who had been imprisoned by the Dutch. The harbor was frozen over. Here's a thing that's happened as recently as 1994, but not since then. And in 1646, the ice extended more than 3 miles. Men with saws crept over the ice and cut a path for the ship over that long distance. Be glad you've never had to do that work. Lamberton's ship was never heard from again. Now to Atwater, quote, "The winter passes away. The icebound harbor breaks into ripples before the soft breezes of the spring. Vessels from England arrive on the coast, but they bring no tidings of the New Haven ship. Vain is the solicitude of wives and children, of kindred and friends. Vain are all inquiries. Month after month, hope waits for tidings. Affection, unwilling to believe the worst, frames one conjecture and another to account for the delay. Perhaps they've been blown out of their track upon some undiscovered shore, from which they will by and by return to surprise us with their safety. Perhaps they've been captured and are now in confinement. How many prayers are offered for the return of that ship and its priceless treasures of life and affection? At last, anxiety gradually settles down into despair. Gradually, they learn to speak of the wise and public-spirited Gregson, the brave and soldier-like Turner, the adventurous Lamberton, that right godly woman, the wife of Mr. Goodyear, and the others, as friends whose faces are never more to be seen among the living. In November 1647, their estates are settled, and they are put upon record as deceased." Back to me. There is, however, a coda, one of the most widely testified stories of the supernatural from early New England. John Winthrop recorded that in June 1648, quote, "There appeared over the harbor at New Haven, in the evening, the form of a keel of a ship with 3 masts, to which were suddenly added the tacking and sails, and presently after, upon the top of the poop, a man standing with one hand akimbo under his left side, and in his right hand a sword stretched out toward the sea. Then from the side of the ship, which was from the town, arose a great smoke which covered all the ship, and in that smoke she vanished away. But some saw her keel sink into the water. This was seen by many, both men and women, and it continued about a quarter of an hour. Back to me. Years later, the Reverend James Pierpont, who succeeded John Davenport as minister of the New Haven Church, responded to Cotton Mather with a letter describing the now famous ghost ship. After recounting the story of its sailing in 1646 and it having been given up for lost the next year, Pierpont wrote, quote, "In June next ensuing, a great thunderstorm arose out of the northwest, after which, the hemisphere being serene, about an hour before sunset, a ship of like dimensions with the aforesaid, with her canvas and colors abroad, though the wind northerly, appeared in the air coming up from our harbor's mouth, which lies southward from the town, seemingly with her sails filled under a fresh gale, holding her course north, and continuing under observation, sailing against the wind for the space of half an hour. Many were drawn to behold this great work of God. Yea, the very children cried out, 'There's a brave ship!' At length, crowding up as far as there is usually water sufficient for such a vessel, and so near some of the spectators, as that they imagined a man might hurl a stone on board her, her main top seemed to be blown off, but left hanging in the shrouds, then her mizzen top, then all our masting seemed blown away by the board. Quickly after the hulk brought to a careen, she overset, and so vanished into a smoky cloud, which in some time dissipated, leaving, as everywhere else, a clear air. The admiring spectators could distinguish the several colors of each part, the principal rigging, and such proportions as caused not only the generality of people to say, 'This was the mold of their ship, and this was her tragic end.' But Mr. Davenport also in public declared to this effect, that God had condescended for the quieting of their afflicted spirits. This extraordinary account of his sovereign disposal of those for whom so many fervent prayers were made continually. Back to me. I'll accept your gratitude for not at this point cutting in a clip from Ghost. There is, after all, no evidence that the phantasmal man with a sword looked like Patrick Swayze. In any case, the Lord works in mysterious ways, and who am I to say it didn't happen? Perhaps the most important lesson of the story, though, is that such manifestly learned men as John Winthrop and James Pierpont thought that it had. The line between the natural and the supernatural was more ambiguous in those days. It's no wonder that such people also believed in witches. Most people who talk about the history of New Haven Colony devote a lot of attention to its extreme Puritanism. Perhaps such unqualified faith led to the ghost ship story, either as a mass delusion or an actual miracle of God. As a not very churched-up American of my generation, I naturally lean to the former explanation. In fact, I believe the ghost ship was a delusion. But that is itself interesting and worth remembering, if nothing other than a measure of the power of intense faith. We moderns often discount that more than we should, I think. Having talked a great deal about Puritanism in the last year and a half, I'm going to skip over the religious stuff, you guys know it, and focus attention instead on the geopolitics that eventually led to the absorption of New Haven into Connecticut. Unlike the Pilgrim Fathers, who brought the accomplished soldier Miles Standish, or the Winthrop Fleet, which sent the sometime soldier John Endicott ahead to prepare the ground, Davenport and Eaton had not brought a soldier to organize the defense. This might seem strange, insofar as the eventual New Haveners were probably the best provisioned group of settlers to reach New England during the 17th century. But, in fairness, They did not know where they were going to land when they left England for Boston, and whether local defense would be an important consideration. Once they decided to go to Quinnipiac, sitting as it was in close proximity to both the Dutch and the Mohawks, they knew they needed at least a trained band, which was the term for the small colonial militias. In this they got lucky. During their winter in Boston in 1638-39, Nathaniel Turner, one of the senior captains during the Pequot War, was among the 150 citizens of the bay who joined the passengers from the Hector to settle at Quinnipiac. He would soon be invested with the military command for the new colony. The General Court of November 25, 1639, only a month after the organization of the government, ordered, quote, that everyone that bears arms shall be completely furnished with arms, viz., a musket, a sword, bandoliers, a pound of powder, 20 bullets fitted to their musket, or 4 pounds of pistol shot or swan shot at least, and be ready to show them in the marketplace upon Monday the 16th of the month before Captain Turner and Lieutenant Seely, under the penalty of 20 shillings fine for every default or absence. Back to me. Turner would remain in command until early 1646, when he departed on Lamberton's ship, never to be seen on this earth again. Men from age 16 to 60, with the usual draft deferments, were obligated to serve, show up for training days, and present arms for inspection 4 times a year. Training was both specifically military, marching, practicing maneuvers, shooting weapons, and all that, and also physical fitness. The General Court ordered that soldiers, quote, do exercise themselves in running, wrestling, leaping, and the like manly exercises, the better to fit their bodies for service and hardship. Eventually, the affluent colony issued its soldiers, in addition to firearms, pikes, swords, and quilted coats that would stop or slow down Indian arrows. A regular night watch was organized. The night watch consisted of one master of the watch and 6 other men, and it rotated among groups of 7 from March 1st until the end of October. Presumably, the winters were so severe, the chances of an attack during the cold months were considered remote. The settlers thought themselves especially vulnerable on the Sabbath, so the General Court further ordered that all members of the night watch were to come to services armed, following the practice adopted by the Pilgrims of Plymouth Colony in its early years. Eventually, New Haven organized an artillery company and purchased 16 horses for pulling the gun carriages or for use by militia cavalry or dragoons. It also had at least 1 gunboat for policing the Long Island Sound. New Haven's preparedness served its purpose, insofar as the colony never went to war. A well-equipped military is both a powerful deterrent. Recall that old slogan of the Strategic Air Command, peace is our profession, and a temptation to war. After all, a powerful military not only deters, but it presents new opportunities. At various times, New Haven wanted to go to war with local tribes and the Dutch, but it had bound itself to Connecticut, Massachusetts Bay, and Plymouth when it joined the United Colonies in 1643. The effect would be to constrain New Haven's military ambitions. New Haven came closest to war in 1653. Super attentive listeners will recall that England and the Netherlands went to war at sea in 1652, the first Anglo-Dutch War. No need to discuss the ins and outs and what have yous. I'll put a link to the Wikipedia page for the war in the show notes, other than to observe that war in Europe did not require war in North America, but it created the opportunity for one. Of the 4 United Colonies, New Haven was the most exposed to the Dutch, and therefore the most hawkish. Now, the Treaty of Hartford in 1650 had established the border between New Netherland and New England at a north-south line 50 miles west of the mouth of the Connecticut River, which effectively put all the New Haven colonies inside New England, except the towns of Stamford and Greenwich, which were, respectively, about 10 and 15 miles outside that line. That point of insecurity was considerably amplified by the Dutch practice of selling guns to the Indians, which the New Englanders believed was inciting violence against their settlements in New Haven and Connecticut. The New Haveners heard rumors of a plot between the Dutch and the Indians against them. When news of the war between England and Holland arrived in New England in the spring of 1653, the United Colonies voted 7-1 to declare war on New Netherland. The sole dissenting vote was Simon Bradstreet of Massachusetts Bay, who we will see again. In principle, a 7-1 vote, both delegates from New Haven, Connecticut, and Plymouth, and one of the delegates from the Bay, cleared the hurdle for the United Colonies to go to war. In practice, there's a big difference between declaring war and waging it. Massachusetts Bay was by far the most populous of the four colonies, and its participation was thought essential to the successful prosecution of a war against Peter Stuyvesant, the hard-nosed governor of New Netherland. The General Court of Massachusetts nullified the decision of the United Colonies on the grounds that there was insufficient evidence of a nefarious plot between the Dutch and the Indians, and refused to supply its quota of troops. The politics behind this decision were a bit complicated, and I'll spare you the deets and suggest you listen to the Other States of America History podcast for the many ins and outs. Naturally, the nullification by Massachusetts triggered something of a constitutional crisis within the United Colonies. New Haven's General Court declared that the Massachusetts General Court had, quote, broken their covenant with us in acting directly contrary to the Articles of Confederation, and resolved to seek redress in England with Cromwell himself. Connecticut Colony joined New Haven in its petition. Oliver Cromwell sided with Connecticut and New Haven, writing in response, quote, unless the Dutch be either removed or subjected, so far at least that these colonies may be freed from injurious affronts and secured against the dangers and mischievous effects which daily flow upon them by their plotting with the Indians and furnish them with arms against the English, and that the league and confederations betwixt the four united English colonies be confirmed and settled according to the true sense, until this year the continued interpretation of the articles, the peace and comfort of these smaller western colonies will be much hazarded. Back to me. Cromwell committed to send a fleet to subjugate New Netherland, and it arrived in Boston at some point in the winter of 1653-54. Massachusetts Bay knew it had been outmaneuvered and agreed to supply 200 soldiers. There were another 200 from Cromwell's fleet, and Connecticut and New Haven were to supply 200 and 133, respectively. An army of more than 700, therefore, backed by English naval guns, would have posed a serious threat to New Amsterdam, notwithstanding the wall that Stuyvesant had built in the last year to protect it from an overland attack from Upper Manhattan. By early July 1654, the New English were ready to attack New Netherland. Fortunately for the Dutch, however, peace had broken out in Europe, and the Treaty of Westminster signed between England and the Netherlands on April 22nd. Stuyvesant had heard of the treaty, and sent messengers to New Haven to ask if they'd heard the same. On July 5th, the General Court of New Haven met and agreed to seek confirmation, which came quickly. There would be no conquest of New Amsterdam in 1654. And, of course, long-standing and attentive listeners know that Stuyvesant took this moment of peace with New England to take over New Sweden in 1655. As those of you who have listened to our recent episode, Oliver's Army, What You Need to Know About the English Civil Wars, the Commonwealth of England fell apart with the death of Oliver Cromwell in 1658, and after some turmoil, the House of Stuart was restored with the coronation of Charles II as king in May 1660. New England had long been a hotbed of Puritan anti-royalists, and suddenly the legitimacy and therefore the independence of the various colonies was again on the table. All four of the United Colonies had reason to be worried that the Crown would take them over, and those worries would increase considerably when it became clear that Massachusetts, Connecticut, and New Haven were all implicated in sheltering at least two of the judges who had signed the death warrant of Charles I in 1649. That story is worth its own episode, so we'll return to it in the future. For now, all you need to know is that New Haven was particularly sneaky in the protection of the regicides, as they became known after the Restoration, and that would compromise its ability to remain independent. New Haven's claim to corporate legitimacy was the weakest, supported only by Indian deeds, which the English did not regard as sufficient, and the implicit recognition of the United Colonies, which, as we have seen, had been considered a legitimate authority by Cromwell, and the new uncertainty following the Stuart Restoration, New Haven sought to define its borders more precisely. The border with New Netherland had been established with Indian deeds and by the Treaty of Hartford, but its border with Connecticut Colony was far less clear. In 1660, New Haven bought some more land from a sachem named Montawese and posted border markings. Sadly for New Haven, this irritated the magistrates of Connecticut profoundly and provoked them into asserting a new claim. It sent the General Court of New Haven a letter that called into question New Haven's independence. Quote, "This court," meaning Connecticut, "having received information not only by what appears in one of your laws respecting the purchase of land from the Indians, wherein there is a seeming challenge of very large interests of lands, and likewise by what intelligence we have had of your stretching your bounds up toward us by marking trees, which things ye entrench upon our interest, so they are not satisfying or contentful, nor do we apprehend it, of course, further or strengthening that friendly correspondency that we desire, especially in that we conceive you cannot be ignorant of our real and true right to these parts of the country where you are seated. And though hitherto we have been silent and altogether forborne to make any absolute challenge to our own, as before, yet now we see a necessity at least to revive the memorial of our right and interest, and therefore do desire that there may be a determinate settlement and mutual concurrence twixt yourselves and this colony in reference to the dividing bounds twixt the two colonies. We desire your return to our general court in reference to our propositions, with what convenient speed may be, that so what is desired by us in point of mutual and neighborly correspondence, according to the rules of justice and righteousness, may be still maintained and continued." Back to me. New Haven screwed around a while in considering this, and by the time it responded with a proposal to negotiate, Connecticut had already dispatched its governor, John Winthrop Jr., to England to procure its own patent. He'd already traveled to New Amsterdam and departed there for England. The politics and correspondence between New Haven and Connecticut during this period are complicated and include a vague promise from Winthrop that he would not sell out New Haven in his negotiations with the Crown. For his part, Winthrop brilliantly worked his connections with the Puritan nobility, now granted immunity by Charles II. The breakthrough came when they surfaced pre-Civil War royal authority for various New England lands, which Winthrop and his aristocratic allies leveraged into a new charter for Connecticut, dated April 23, 1662. Edward Atwater describes the result, quote, "The new charter was in every respect as Winthrop would desire it to be. The boundaries of the territory it confirmed to Connecticut were the same as in the patent of 1631. With regard to the powers of government, The charter was still more extraordinary. It conferred on the colonists unqualified power to govern themselves. They were allowed to elect all their own officers, to enact their own laws, to administer justice without appeals to England, to inflict punishments, to confer pardons, and, in a word, to exercise every power, deliberative and active. The king, far from reserving a negative on the acts of the colony, did not even require that the laws should be transmitted for his inspection, and no provision was made for the interference of the English in any event whatsoever. Connecticut was independent, except in name. Clearly, the terms of the charter were dictated by Winthrop. Both the boundaries and the powers of government were such as he asked for. He was resolved, when he left Hartford, to ask for all the territory included in the old patent, even if the line should reach so as to include a sister colony. Back to me. This was good news for Connecticut, and potentially good news for New Haven Colony. Atwater says that Winthrop had no desire to absorb New Haven Colony by compulsion, but thought it in New Haven's best interest to do, especially given its dodgy reputation for having sheltered the regicides. There were those in New Haven who agreed with Winthrop, including William Leet, who is now the governor, Theophilus Eaton having died in 1658. There were also those who did not agree, including John Davenport. Some of the concerns were purely provincial. Hartford was a long way away from New Haven in 1662, and people naturally want to govern themselves. But much of it had to do with differences in governance. Many New Haveners were committed to their theocracy, government according to the scriptures and the franchise limited to the elect. Connecticut was much more liberal by the standards of the day. Submitting to Connecticut would inevitably bend New Haven to the secular. Over the next couple of years, Connecticut applied persistent diplomatic pressure on New Haven and its spin-off colonies. It flipped Stamford, Guilford, and Greenwich into its orbit, all the while negotiating with New Haven, with a weaker colony desperately trying to preserve autonomy for its governance. New Haven appealed to the United Colonies, now a shell of its former legitimacy, which essentially demurred, other than to say that Connecticut should not actually conquer New Haven. By 1663, even John Winthrop Jr., who'd been patient and hoped for diplomacy, supported increased pressure. Next, Milford caved, as did Stamford. Only tiny Branford stuck with New Haven. Still, the negotiations continued with hilarious tedium, the two colonies firing off long letters with governance proposals, responses to them, Connecticut's patience obviously running thin with each back and forth. Charles II had given his brother, the Duke of York, Long Island and the English claims to New Netherland, and in August 1664, four English frigates sailed into New Amsterdam Harbor and forced its surrender without firing a shot. Peter Stuyvesant signed over New Netherland to the English and retired to his farm in Manhattan, where he would live in peace until 1672. New Haven was now surrounded. Geopolitically speaking, its choice was to submit to York or to Connecticut. Knowing the jig was up, on December 13, 1664, New Haven submitted to Connecticut. There was a coda. Only the spin-off town of Branford refused to give in. Its minister, Abraham Pearson, led almost the entire congregation to New Jersey, where they would found a new town according to their beliefs, which they would name New Ark. But that's another story. Thank you again for listening to the History of the Americans podcast. Your emails have been very encouraging. Please keep them coming. You can reach me with questions, corrections, eruptions of indignation, or pats on the back on the contact page for the website, thehistoryoftheamericans.com, or by email at thehistoryoftheamericans@gmail.com. And please do me the great favor of giving the podcast a 5-star rating on Apple and following me on X for cranky musings on mostly history-related matters. Until next time.